So in the absence of an actual tour of the Salk Institute, we're going to do a brief virtual tour. And your guide for this occasion is a longtime resident of the Salk Institute, a denizen in De Verma.
Thank you. I had a few slides left for my talk. I'd like to just go through them again. So I have been assigned the task of talking about the Salk Institute, a place near and dear to my heart. I first came to the Salk Institute in 1972. I wish, actually, you guys had a chance to come, and you're all welcome to come anytime, by the way. And then in 74, I became an assistant professor, so I've been there for 33 years. And I can safely say there isn't a day that I entered the Salk Institute that I'm not as excited at that April of 19th, 1974, when I came as an assistant professor. I'm sure everybody feels the same about their institutions, their homes, but there's something very special about the Salk Institute. Part of it has to do with its architecture. And that has to do with the fact that Louis Kahn, some of you probably know of him, was a famous American architect who died almost like 15 years ago or so. And some of you might have actually seen the movie called My Architect that was made by Louis Kahn's son. Now, Louis Kahn was an interesting man. He had three simultaneous families. I don't know how many of you can imagine doing that, but that's what he had. And this son was from one of those families who actually then figured out how his father managed to live with three wives simultaneously in the same city, actually, within a mile area of each other. So, but what I think attracted to when Jonas Salk became a national hero for the providing the vaccine for polio, the March of Diamond in gratitude offered him the possibility of building an institute to do research. And Jonas always thought art and science must go hand in hand together. That was his motto. And the first place he thought the building should be built in Pittsburgh because that's where he was. But the president of University of Pittsburgh didn't want it because he didn't want a competing star in his same institution. But apparently, Robert Oppenheimer, who happened to be on the board of Pittsburgh University at that time, suggested to Jonas, go west, young man. Everything happens the west of this country. So he came, and at the place that he had first in his mind, some of you may know, if you go to the San Francisco Golden Gate Bridge, you go north. On the left-hand side, there's a big top mountain there. That was the first site that were proposed, and some drawings were done. But then the mayor of San Diego, who was a polio victim himself, offered free land from San Diego to build this, and that's what is on the mesa here. It was originally called the La Jolla Institute, but Jonas wanted to call it La Jolla Institute, but the city wanted to be called it Salk Institute. The interesting thing about the Salk Institute building is that originally, so this was my acknowledgement slide, and I took everybody's acknowledgement off, so you can actually see the building looks like. This is how the Salk Institute, if you enter it, there are two halves. Originally, if you see the old, and you'll see, the reason we are doing this is because you're getting a book from Louis Kahn, and you might see the drawings where there actually were four such buildings. And that actually, I have even seen a model of that, Jonas's house at one time. And very quickly, Jonas discarded the idea because he felt the body is bilateral, two eyes, two parts of the brain, two ears. So that was his idea of building a building which has two halves to it representing the human body itself. And the way the building is designed is that we have 16,000 square feet of space on each floor, and there are three floors on this side, three on this side. So it's about 96,000 actual working space. And those of you who have the opportunity to visit us or will visit us, you will notice that the way Jonas had in his mind, he called it an undifferentiated space. That's how he used the word, which actually is quite a nice word if you think about it. And then you can differentiate into cell biology, molecular biology, neurobiology, or cancer biology. So the floor, the way they are designed, in fact, there are no walls in between. It's really one, and my and Tony's fond dream is to be able to hit a tennis ball from one end to 16,000 feet on the other end. We haven't succeeded because everybody has their refrigerators in the middle or something. But nevertheless, that was the idea. And you can change the room or building anytime because you can very quickly put partitions if you wish to do so. And the other unique feature of this building is that between the floors, if you go to the Salk lab, you will see no pipes, no tubes, no waters running, no gas pipes. Everything is hidden between two floors. So in between the floor, there's an interstitial floor where all this stuff is, and from there all the material is sent down to the normal lamp. That actually makes it look relatively more attractive. There are 1,100 people who work at the Salk Institute, about 555 faculty, and 350 graduate students, and about 350 postdocs and 120 graduate students. In 1995, we built a new building, this is the Pacific Ocean. Then we built a new building a little east of that, which caused a lot of consternation among the aficionados of the building, because Salk Institute is the seventh highest best ranked building in the United States, just one below the Chrysler and one above the Vietnam Memorial. So there was a lot of hue and cry that why are we building something in front of it? Of course, we want space, right? But the architectural community didn't care about that. So we eventually prevailed, and I personally think the building came out to be pretty nice because it is sort of framing the old building. So in a limited amount of time that I have, all I can tell you is that it's a very interesting architect. If you have the opportunity to visit it, because one of the other things the architect wanted to show, some of you might see these pockmarked holes here, and that is really how buildings are made and then they are covered up. So the idea for Louis Kahn was to have the original state of the building is how do we make the buildings. And it's actually quite remarkable. It's 1966 is when the building opened. It's now the 41st year of the building, and it is actually in a remarkably good shape. There's almost no real major wear and tear to this building. So he's done really a remarkable job. And of course, the most impressive is the courtyard. When you come from this side, originally there used to be a grove of eucalyptus, but now there's a building, and suddenly you walk up and you see the whole Pacific Ocean opening in front. And in the evening, when the sun sets, it's actually really quite a lovely setting. And in fact, we have annually a symphony at the Salk Institute in the evening, and that one will be on 26th, which is a marvelous setting, because you see on the back the ocean, and it's really a wonderful place to have that kind of function. I've always hoped we'll have some kind of a Greek tragedy, because there's so much of the color and time of the evening over there. So that's a little bit about the building. My colleagues can add more to it. Moon is usually in the evening, yeah?
This is actually a fake shot, right? Let's be honest.
So what Jeff is trying to see, it's not easy to explain this until you see. What Jeff is trying to do, this is the east end. And that's the west end because of where the ocean is. When you enter from this thing, this is called the stream of life. That's what I'm told it is called. I don't exactly know that. And that's oriented towards the ocean, so there's a bit of a waterfall over here. But it's hard to describe it. You have to just feel it. You will enter this, you will suddenly feel the opening of the plaza. And it gives you a sense. It doesn't look like it's an institute for science. It looks more like a old art building or so on, but in fact it's known for science. And different people have different take on it. Some people thought it was a gigantic condominium. I know. Everybody has their own way. One thought it was it looked like a very deserted place. But to us who work here, to me at least, and here is Ron is here, and Jeff is here, and Tony is here, they can tell you more of their own feeling.
Recently, I guess because of global warming, it's been foggy. So this year we had the lab go out there to take our picture. And it had been beautiful, and then suddenly, when this glorious moment was to occur, there was this fog, it got cold, and I had to hold up a lemon in the picture, indicating where the sun should have been if you could have seen it through the fog. Anyway.
I have never sunk this low myself.
Andrew, you got to get a life. What can I say?
Thank you. I'm happy to ask the afterwards question, and my colleagues, and again, we'll be delighted if you wanted to visit our institute.
But it actually is what Jeff was saying there, it actually is a stunning moment because when the sun actually sets on the equinox, there's a red flash goes straight down the pool. And it's quite startling. Right, that's right. Yeah, because of the after effect. So, Tim, you're up. So next, we're going to a talk by Tim Yateman from Moffitt Cancer Center.
Thank you for inviting me here. I appreciate the invitation from Jason Kuhn and appreciate the vision of the PanCAN organization. I think it's appropriate for me to speak today because we're trying to meet the challenge of a new vision. And I think it's appropriate to follow an architectural talk, because I'm going to try to present to you sort of the architecture of what we consider personalized cancer care in the future. And it really does involve exploiting molecular tools and a systems approach to doing this. If you read the Wall Street Journal yesterday, there was an article on the front page that kind of struck me. It was about a gentleman named Gary Armon, who started a small company called Antigenics, and they submitted their work to the FDA, and it failed because they didn't have the mandatory 10% response rate in the therapy. And the quote from Dr. Temple at the FDA is kind of telling. He says at the end of all this, he says, companies ought to spend more time before starting trials trying to find the population most likely to benefit. And so that's sort of the FDA stance on all this, and I'm going to give you our approach to trying to do that. So we sort of call this Total Cancer Care. It's a new initiative at the Moffitt Cancer Center. As you've heard, pancreas is a deadly disease, and so are many other cancers, but certainly pancreas is quite prominent. And the problem, as we heard, is both twofold. You've heard a lot about the science problem, the scientific problem, understanding the molecular pathways and then trying to interrupt those pathways. It's not so simple with all the feedback loops and things we've heard about. But the other part you haven't heard about is the translation piece. And the little known dirty secret is that translational science is very difficult. To conduct clinical trials in the current way we do them is inherently flawed. They're extremely time-consuming, expensive, and ineffective. And we're actually treating the wrong patients most of the time, as evidenced by the fact that most of the trials fail. So, you know, what's personalized cancer care? This is a definition promoted by a former NCI director, and it was the use of molecular signatures to sort of accelerate the development of new drugs targeted to specific subpopulations of patients. And I've adapted that to a new definition, which is the use of molecular signatures to match the right patients to the right drugs, first in clinical trials and in practice. So the problem with contemporary cancer care is that, and this applies to all cancers, but I put pancreas in here, it's a complex heterogeneous disease. And some may feel that it's homogeneous, but when you take it apart, there's a few patients that do respond. We cure a few patients with surgery. Many patients fail. Some metastasize widely, some metastasize not so widely. But the bottom line is many patients are treated to help an unknown few. And it's really one-size-fits-all approach. The drug therapy is not tailored to the patient, and response rates are low, and toxicity is generally high. The phase two trials we do are really to test the efficacy of response rate of a drug for the first time. And patients are recruited to these trials on a first-come, first-served basis with no knowledge of target in most cases. I look at all the trials we're performing today, and not many of them have biopsies or associated pre-screening events. The response to new drugs are generally hit or miss. 50% of the phase two drugs are retired, and millions are lost, and there's about two steps backwards in each case. This just shows you in pancreatic cancer the fact that gemcitabine and 5-FU have been used for years, and where they show significant p-values and clinical benefit response and so forth. The real effect on the patient is an improvement in months and not years. So we think the solution to this problem is to really have a radical change in the way we do things. And it took us a while to find any group that would really want to invest in this concept, because it is a little bit out there. We call it total cancer care, and it's a concept of studying large populations to find the molecular subpopulations we know exist, and to then develop therapies for those individuals. It's really developing a large number of niche therapies, essentially. And there are some examples already where this has happened. Gleevec is one, and there are many others coming down the pike, we hope. But the concept is to build this infrastructure, starting with a number of hospitals. And we started with the Moffitt Cancer Center, which covers a large portion of the state of Florida. It's the only NCI-designated comprehensive cancer center in the state, and Florida is secondary only to California in terms of cancer burden, and is projected to surpass it within 6 years based on the incoming influx of people and the age of those people. So we've developed an affiliate network and a consortium, sort of a generic consortium of hospitals that would like to participate in this project statewide. And the concept involves pipeline therapeutic trials, which is really the main driver on what's in it for hospitals to participate. It involves tissue banking, building a central data warehouse, developing molecular signatures. Of course, IT solutions are a big part of this, and we can do lots of other projects like quality improvement and evidence-based medicine projects with this. We would like this to lead to and culminate in trial enrichment, and I'll speak a little bit more about that in a minute, which ultimately leads to a new standard of care and what we call personalized medicine. So the mission of this project initiative is to contribute to the cure of cancer, identify the right drug for the right patient, improve the performance of clinical trials through molecular profiling, and that's not just gene expression, it could be other approaches, and to measure and improve the performance and quality of care. So you have to be asleep not to see the large number of studies done with profiling, and we've done a lot of them in our lab for a number of years in colon cancer, and you know, one of the things we learned is that this profiling approach is very sensitive. And it's very sensitive to the inputs, and so you know, if you don't carefully macro dissect your samples, or even laser capture micro dissect your samples, your answer is going to be skewed. And many of the studies I point out, the earlier studies were done without any of this, and so a number of the studies done with really on the belief that what was going into the specimen is what was thought to be or projected to be cancer. We're using a commercial platform today. We started off with cDNA microarrays a number of years ago, but these are fairly reproducible today and lot-to-lot and so forth, and allows you now to really do a whole genome investigation on a single chip. With this, we started looking at human tumors, and we first took on the challenge of trying to distinguish different cancer types and that a look-alike under the microscope, and most pathologists, not given the code on the right, would tell you these all are adenocarcinoma, but probably couldn't pick out necessarily F as the pancreatic carcinoma, for example, without special stains. But yet it's fairly easy to do this with molecular profiling. There are some fairly specific tissue fingerprints, and it turns out that tumors of the unknown primary origin can be identified as well. Some of these gene expressions are in fact carried through even poorly differentiated tumors and metastatic tumors, so allowing you to identify sites of unknown origin for these tumors. And of course today we treat by the site of origin, so that's still important. You can stage patients probably more accurately with molecular approaches, and we show this in colon cancer, but it's been shown in breast cancer and lung cancer, that molecular approaches can often exceed what's done by standard clinico-anatomic staging systems. And of interest is that the genes, at least, that have fallen out in our approaches have been genes that do seem to have some effect on tumor growth, angiogenesis, invasion, motility, and so forth. So the genes that you might anticipate be associated with poor prognosis, in fact, appear to have some biological underpinnings. You can create personalized gene prediction models for patients that are probably better than the standard staging, which really gives patients almost a 50-50 prediction. And clinicians are often confused as to whether to give patients chemotherapy or not, or how to treat patients in this disease. And we think this will be important for many solid tumors. So this total cancer care project we're involved in now is really not just a tissue bank, and it's not a cohort study. It's quite a massive effort to collect and consent patients for a lifetime follow-up. It's fairly easy to collect tumor tissues. It's another thing to collect tumor tissues with good quality clinical data, and it's still another thing to consent them for additional follow-up and perhaps recontact With all of the IRB regulations and sort of blocks that we have in the way of doing research today. So we set out to do this in a very electronic way with digital consenting, and the plan is to profile a large number of tumors initially with gene profiling, but perhaps with other technologies in the future. At the same time, collecting blood samples and paraffin samples and urine samples and so forth. But again, the goal is to really create a sort of a massive database for the patient, the clinician, and the researcher to interrogate and really use the human being as the model for cancer, as perhaps closest approximating the true condition. And so we like to ultimately end up in population-based trial enrichment. And that's where we have the potential to actually recontact patients in the future from a database of matched gene expression, finding the right patient for the right drug. So how did we get there and how are we doing this? And it all starts with a consent process, that's all electronic, and surveys that are done electronically. We modeled the nursing health study out of Boston to create a cancer-specific survey. We capture tissues that are snap frozen with strict, rigid SOPs. They're all macrodissected by a pathologist and graded for all of the things we'd like to see, percent tumor, percent stroma, necrosis, et cetera. And then every step of the RNA or DNA that's extracted is checked with QC along the way. And then the actual samples imaged for histology and archived, along with all of the clinical data that we can collect from both the patients, cancer registries, pathology reports, op reports, and ultimately a CRF, a case report form from the physician and the nurse involved. So it involves a lot of people. And we're using a tool that we found locally in Orlando and since was purchased by NCR, and it's basically a handheld tablet without a hard drive, and it allows us to collect all the clinical data from patients without storing it locally, so there's no chance of loss of information, and all of the data is collected, identified, but released de-identified, so we have the HIPAA issues are answered here. Once the patient's consented, it's immediately ported to our electronic medical record, and so physicians or clinicians know immediately the patient was consented, and then they can perform whatever procedure they need to perform. We collect a lot of demographic data, and this can be quality of life. This can be questions for risk factors, family history, and so forth. Where does all this data go? One of the problems that we found was, you know, getting all the data together for a group of scientists to look at it. And it's one thing to say, I'd like to get, you know, 50 or 100 colon cancer cases, and I'd like to have all the clinical data together and put it in a database for me that's relational, and get me the cell files, and let's start creating some signatures. It's another thing to do it for, you know, 10 to 20,000 patients, and to get the survival data and the response data and all those other things. So we had to build a data warehouse, which is a big store for all of these data points, and it's linked to our cancer registry, our EMR, this Galvanon tool. It's linked to the clinical pathologic data that comes in. It's linked to a CRF. It's linked to gene expression data and proteomics data and anything else we put in there. The problem then is how do you view it? And so we actually are one of the pilot sites for a software program called Azixi. It is a very interesting tool that we're trying out that allows you to look on your desktop at all of these elements and sort them very quickly in real time, including images. So you might ask, what's a warehouse? And it's really a bunch of servers and storage, terabytes of storage. Really the goal is to give views to the patient ultimately in an EMR situation, or the clinician who might want to look at Kaplan-Meier curves and compare data, prospective data collected to SEER data, or the basic researcher who wants to bring in gene expression or sequencing data or what have you with all of the clinical data. This is just to remind us that current models are fairly simplistic, and this approach offers us the potential to fully understand the molecular targets, pathways, and the heterogeneity we believe exists in cancers. And we think this involves the analysis of many hundreds of tumors is likely necessary. So the milestones to date, to show you this is more than just a dream now, we have defined some infrastructure. We actually did a quality improvement project that was submitted and published that allowed us to compare data from clinical data from multiple sites. But we actually have an informed consent that's been approved by six IRBs, and we're on version 8.0, so it gives you an idea of flavor for how much regulatory controls are involved in this process. We have a survey, informed consent, and a video informed consent and an introduction to the TCC concept for patients that I'll show you in a minute, all functional on this tablet. And then the patients actually go in and consent on the tablet. They sign, and their electronic signature is captured as a PDF, and that's ported to the central data warehouse. So the pilot study was completed, and we're now in real time in the real study, and we've consented about 7,000 patients in the last year and 3 months, and about 2,000 tumors have been collected, and we're now profiling about 88 a week. So the funding, you might say, well, who would fund something like this? Because it's kind of a large, big science idea. But initially, Moffitt spent a lot of time investing in this, and so did the National Functional Genomics Consortium at Moffitt. But then Merck and Company decided to partner with us, and we thought it was actually a good match because we realized that we needed a real drug company to really help identify novel agents and ultimately commercialize them and bring them to patients and perform clinical trials and so forth. And then the state of Florida stepped up as well. Just like we saw Torrey Pines, the Burnham, and come down from La Jolla, but transferred by Jeb Bush as satellites to the state of Florida and Scripps, we've seen the state of Florida invest in this concept. So population-based trial enrichment is this concept of trying to find the right patient for the right drug trial. And so the concept here was that we built this big database with thousands of patients, and then we might be able to go in and proactively find the right ones. So to do that, we started thinking about it. You can't just have primary tumors. You probably need metastatic tumors as well. So we had to build a protocol around collecting both. And so that means we actually have to start pushing for biopsies. And that means patients have to undergo not one biopsy for diagnosis, but additional pass the needle for sampling for research. And this is the tricky part of clinical research, to actually get these biopsies. And so we're working very hard to get patients consented, speak to them about the program, and hopefully most patients participate to allow us to access their tumor, both primary and metastatic. The concept is that if you could biopsy about 2.5 lung cancer patients a day, for example, and you assumed a median survival of 6 months, you'd have a stable disease population after about a year of 300 patients. And if you assumed only a 10% target, you'd have 30 patients at any one time for a trial match. So this was made about 8 years ago. We thought about this, where you would biopsy a patient and go to some sort of central library and ask, what's the diagnosis, you know, what's the prognosis, and perhaps what's the therapy. And the therapy might be a responder, non-responder signature, or it might be, in fact, a specific match. This, we believe, will streamline clinical trials if it works. It's certainly a home run. The way trials are conducted now is very laborious. I just looked at some data from a trial we're running with biopsies, and we've accrued 85 patients in about a year and 2 months to a colon cancer trial. And each one of those patients had biopsies, but only 20 of the patients were ultimately usable in the study. So it's very difficult to do these trials, and particularly as they become translational. But if, in fact, you could do a trial more effectively and perhaps have a response rate that's not 10%, but 20 or 30%, and do the trial with fewer patients, then the costs come down on the trial and the trial's done faster. So the TCC principles were, there's a little efforts required from a lot of people to make a success. And we've gone out to numerous partners throughout the state of Florida and beyond, and really talked to hospitals, doctors, nurses, administrators to encourage them to be on board for the long term. It's not a typical therapeutic clinical trial where a lot of burdens on a few data managers. And the key to this whole project is really discrete or synoptic data collection. And we don't do that today. I mean, it's very easy in the lab to collect numbers and calipers on tumor sizes in mice, but, you know, pathologists generally often don't record the CAP, College of American Pathology codes, in a synoptic, discrete fashion. The medical oncologists rarely record responses as you would in terms of measurements, so that they could be put into a database. Most medicine today is text-driven, and even the text-based tools, the artificial intelligence tools, are not sophisticated enough to pull that stuff out of the text, even if it's there. So it's a big challenge to get discrete data into this database, but that's the key. We've set this system up so that any pharma can request trial matching and come to us with a molecular signature that can be matched to the database. Of course, the key is to find that signature. So we think that patients can be proactively selected and notified of trial opportunities based on a personal molecular profile, which is completely different from the way we do it today, which is we wait for the patients to come to us. And of course, that's very time consuming. And even if we screen for a marker such as AKT activation, we still have to screen hundreds of patients to find the few, and we have to wait for them to come to us. So it's an approach that needs a paradigm shift, quite frankly. So the remaining challenges for us, we believe, are discrete data capture from all disciplines. And it starts with pathology and medical oncology, but extends into other therapies. Objective measures of tumor response. There's a lot of controversy on how to measure whether or not a tumor is responding or not. And any one physician asked, did this tumor respond or not, you'll have controversy over that recording. You wouldn't think it would be so controversial. But do you measure it in two dimensions, or do you measure it in three? Do you measure a volume, or a bidimensional, or a single dimension? And how much, what's the range, and what's the standard deviation on those measurements? And who's measuring it? Is it a radiologist or a clinician? So that's one concept. The other concept is to go towards progression-free survival. That's a little different way of looking at patient responses, and it's not necessarily based on measuring tumors. We think we need to change the practice patterns of physicians by biopsying patients with metastatic disease before treatment. You would think that would be a standard sort of approach, but with PET scans and some of the molecular imaging tools that we have today, if you see a metastatic lesion, you just say, well, I'll just treat, and then there's no biopsy and no information. And IT solutions are a big part of this. So once we've developed this warehouse, which is underway, and we're doing expression profiling, we think there are a number of other things that can be done. With proper support, and that would be, you know, plasma proteomics, looking for biomarkers. It might be single cell sequencing, looking for somatic mutations. It might be looking for amplification or LOH and epigenetic changes. And also I have here molecular imaging as an important component of this. This was just to remind me of, I'm a surgeon, and this was a case I had where we looked at physical imaging, which is a CT scan, and you'll see here the portal vein. There's this little dent here, and it shows you how good these scans are on the anatomic side, because you go clinically here and you see there's that little portal vein being drawn into the tumor. So a lot of the processes you've been talked about today are sort of summarized here: the invasion of the tumor, the fibrosis. You can see how hard that tumor is, and how hard to resect it is too. And you can also see this is really, as I said yesterday, the seat of the soul, and explains in my mind why you see early metastasis, because of all the lymphatics just surrounding this gland. Let's see here. This was just to remind me that you know, the future is going to be molecular imaging, and this is an image that I got from Edward Eichmann that shows you the resolution of the new PET scanning approaches and SPECT scanning. I understand they're making SPECT scanners now, not with the sodium iodide crystals, but with all electronic components. And so the resolution is in micron range. So, you know, one concept, and it was alluded to by Dr. Rosen, was that the current approach to imaging is this, and you may not know it, but we treat patients. We usually get a CAT scan and then a PET scan of some sort, and then we start systemic therapy when the diagnosis of metastatic disease has been obtained. And then we generally wait, and often wait 2 months, sometimes three, to start getting another set of scans and trying to determine whether or not this patient is responding or not. But unfortunately, in that period of time, most patients progress. And so there can be a three-month delay or 2 to 3 month delay in tumor assessment. And the assessment's generally structural, not functional. And patients have one chance for response and most don't. So, you know, with the approach of newer scanning approaches, you can see here that an MRI scan would show a response here pre-treatment, post-treatment in the brain. And that a scan with a more metabolic approach, PET-based, can show a same sort of response perhaps in a week. And the hope would be that we can look for induction of apoptosis or inhibition of proliferation within hours of giving the drug and sort of generally rapidly, iteratively change the drug if there's a non-response prediction, giving these patients more opportunities to participate in more clinical trials and more chance for potential effect. Coincidentally with this, there's an explosion of nucleotides that are now available through cyclotrons that can be used for imaging or therapy. They can be incorporated in drugs or attached to antibodies and imaged with PET scanning or the gamma cameras. And then the therapeutic, they can be converted to some sort of chemotherapies, and chemoradiotherapies, in essence, by combining these tags. So we think the path to personalized medicine starts with really tissue collection and signature development. And we're starting with gene expression profiling because it's a robust technology. We think next will be sequencing and then proteomics to follow. But then we'd like to use this data, once we get it into a significant database and size, to do trial matching to try to really radically change the way we do translational medicine. And I think molecular imaging is a very important component of this because it will not only allow us to image these tumors as they're being treated, know whether the drug's hitting the target, but perhaps it can supplant the biopsy approach at some point in time by identifying with screening up front which patients might respond to the drugs. And we sort of call this a new standard of integrated healthcare. We're actually having a Total Cancer Care Conference in the Bahamas in October, if you're interested. I just wanted to show you one small, those little advertisement. Here's another, I want to show you a video clip of what patients see when they come to Moffitt. And we actually have this, it's Moffittized, but it's also, for all of our other participants, it's more generic. So this is what patients will see.
Hello, I'm Sam Donaldson, chairman of Moffitt Cancer Center's National Board of Advisors. I'd like to talk about a new and exciting opportunity for you to make a real difference in the fight against cancer. Scientists have made great strides in treating this disease, but today's cancer treatments don't work for everyone in the same way every time. Sometimes doctors treat hundreds of patients with cancer drugs, while only a few will get well. Doctors at Moffitt Cancer Center would like to change those odds. They've developed a new vision of medicine called Total Cancer Care that will allow them to create personalized cancer treatments for future patients. Total Cancer Care will also include a network of partners across the state of Florida that will allow patients to participate in the same clinical research studies available at Moffitt without leaving their communities. With recent advances in science, we've found that about 30,000 genes can be tested in any tumor that provides a fingerprint or marker that is specific to that tumor. By studying these tumor fingerprints and comparing their responses to specific treatment drugs, scientists will be able, over time, to identify drugs that will attack each tumor best. Ultimately, this personal molecular data will give physicians the knowledge they need to tailor treatment for patients with your type of cancer. This is called personalized medicine. We want to make a difference and advance the fight against this devastating disease, but we can't do it without you. How can you help? Well, Total Cancer Care is all about information. With your consent, scientists will study your medical history, treatment, follow-up, and samples of your tumor and blood. Moffitt Cancer Center and your doctor will ensure that your personal information remains private. Total Cancer Care will require establishing an enormous database with tens of thousands of patients willing to share details about their care. It's only through the study of large numbers of people that scientists can know with certainty how well current treatments are working. The results of this research may help treat future cancer patients, much like you. It also may help us find new clinical trial opportunities that might benefit you. As a cancer survivor myself, I encourage you to ask your doctor about Total Cancer Care. And if you're asked to participate, please consider becoming a part of Total Cancer Care.
So that's what the patients see, and you know, with this approach, I can say that you know, we of course have an informed consent video as well that goes in much more detail about risks and benefits of participating. But the surprise factor is that 93 or 95% of patients approached have agreed to participate, and that involves not only gifting their tumor resected at surgery, but actually having an additional pass of the needle at the time of diagnosis, which is critical to getting tissue from metastatic lesions, and we think critical to understanding the biology of some of these cancers that are quite resistant to the drugs we're currently using. So, happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. So now we know where Sam went.
Yes.
Right. Mace, you're going to essentially comment first on this, open the discussion, and Tim, can you...
Right, although it calls me to be a moderator, I'd like to consider myself a provocateur here and raise the
several issues. No, that's Neil Rosen's stuff. I'm sorry.
That wasn't in the dictionary. So tissue collection annotation is, I think, without question, a desirable thing. We've learned quite a lot over the decades when this has been done. But I think we also have to address the realities and ask ourselves, what are the limitations and problems with this approach? We have to be careful, especially after viewing the video, of what we promise or overpromise to patients, and what we say and what they hear might be different things. And then I think it would be good to address whether the use of genetic or proteomic signatures as predictive or prognostic biomarkers in pancreatic cancer is an appropriate starting point, the best use of available resources, and anywhere close to matching the right patient to the right drug. So those are sort of the comments to try and get the discussion started. Raise your hand if you have any questions or would like to address any of those points, and wait for a microphone to reach you.
Tim, that was a nice presentation. Just a more practical question. You have a patient who comes in, they have all of these testing done, they have a biopsy as part of their diagnostic workup. They have a molecular signature. Let's say it doesn't meet any open clinical trials. What happens to those patients? Are they essentially waiting for a study to open, or do you do something else for them? Or I guess the question I have is, with all these things coming in here, it sounds like you would have to have a very sizable number of clinical trials to be open to support all the different potential the patients that you have. And so I'm just trying to figure out how you make this kind of match that you talk about in the presentation.
I don't think this is on. It's a good question. Well, some of this obviously is unknown territory. This project just began really in January. So we really don't quite know the answer to your question right now. I would expect that there'll be a lot more patients than there are trials. And there may be the other, you know, important question will be, will there be overlap? Are there going to be a number of patients competing for the same, essentially, drug if you're in different diseases? All of a sudden, maybe lung cancer, maybe there's an AKT pathway signature that covers, you know, multiple diseases. And maybe there's multiple drugs, but perhaps they're competing for the same small subset of patients. I don't know the answer to that yet. But certainly all these patients are available for standard approaches in clinical trials today, which is basically random match.
idea?
I think that given the difficulty in translational research, this is a wonderful step in the right direction. I really hope that it takes off and goes well. Can you tell me how early in the carcinogenic process you go? In other words, do you collect tissue from individuals at high risk, or do you have any intent of collecting tissues from individuals before a cancer actually forms?
Well, we aren't doing that currently in this protocol because we just want to get off the ground and try to hit some certain specific milestones. But certainly that's an open option. We do have a group that does focus on BRCA1 patients and high-risk patients in pancreatic cancer, and certainly that's a way to go. We've collected polyps, for example, in colon cancer, and we've collected a number of pancreatic cysts and pre-malignant pancreatic lesions. They just come in as part of the program. So I think by default we will have a number of pre-malignant lesions included in the project. But we haven't targeted that per se.
Okay. Tim.
Yes.
Yeah, so that was a terrific description of the program. I had really two sort of questions. The first is, how fast is the turnaround time of the markers? Because unless that's very rapid, then the process won't work. When people have tried to do these targeted clinical trials, if you have a 3-week turnaround time for your marker to come back, that's just too long. If you can do it within a week or two, usually that suffices. But I think that's one of the questions that has to be addressed in trying to do this, is you've got to have a very rapid process for identifying all the targets.
Well, you know, one of the reasons we partnered with Merck was because of their Rosetta capabilities, and that lab does the ability to turn around thousands of samples in a short period of time. Currently, it's 30 days. We'd like to target 2 weeks. So I think as the project progresses, we'll get into the 2-week window.
Yeah, just from a practical standpoint, knowing the trials that have looked at this, 3 weeks probably is too long, so 2 weeks is probably right. The second question is, so you've done this, and as you know, most major centers are trying to do equivalent types of things in different ways. So I'm sure Vanderbilt has something along the same lines, Memorial, Johns Hopkins. We've done, essentially everything that's there, but, piecemeal mostly. But the pieces are there. The question is, how do we make this easier for everybody else? How do we work together to not make this just, a unique program at Moffitt that can do all these things with a lot of funding, but something that really can apply across the country? Those elements of this that we could really work together on to make the process easier to identify, how to do the trials better, those types of things?
That's a good question. In as we've been seeking out partners to do this, there are some groups that are very very easy to work with and happy to collaborate in a true partnership, and others don't. And so I think there's a basic politics of collaboration that can get in the way or can be very help it move forward. So we're looking for, in this project, we've looked for partners that are willing to work with us and make it happen. So I think I come from the perspective that almost anything's possible, but there are a lot of hurdles when you start involving patients, tissues, and data. And I can just leave it at that.
I have a question that relates to the one size doesn't fit all for cancer, and you've got a model here. We have many different cancer types plugging in through one system. Pancreatic cancer is very unique in its behavior. You have an intense desmoplastic stroma, very few neoplastic glands. How do you handle that? You can microdissect, but you may only microdissect a couple glands. It seems for pancreatic cancer, you have to step out, maybe go to xenografting or some way to enrich for neoplastic population. Because if you don't, you're going to get the wrong answer. You're going to be analyzing stroma.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And we've we're in deep conversations about do we go xenografts to sort of purify the pancreatic tumor. We've stayed away from laser capture microdissection because it makes it hard to compare to the rest of the samples. But we are trying to do our best to trim down these samples and then qualify them pathologically. I think that's the most important thing. They're all reviewed by two pathologists and in a very sort of rigid way. So at least we know, and we have images of them, so we know and can review the pathology and see what went into it. In a perfect world, you're right, you'd like to have a pure tumor and different approaches for each tumor. And I think pancreas is one that warrants that, also prostate cancer in a similar way.
And I have another question in the news now. Moffitt's been in the news with its partnership with Merck. Can you address some of the ethical issues that you think that may lead to?
Sure. We took 18 months to develop this, and there are a lot of ethical issues, and I can say that we had to tackle a lot of them head on. Most of them came from the way we got out of the ethical conundrums was to ask the question, what's best for the patient? That was number one. And what's in it for, the hospital, the physician, the patient, and the partner. And so as you work through the various issues, we had to ask those questions, and that's how we tackled them. So patients had to come first, and all of our rules that we work around basically are based on that concept. So we actually had a couple ethicists involved in framing the documents and patient advocates as well. And so I think that the combination of advocates and ethicists really helped as well.
It seems as if you've left out one potentially important component, and that is laboratory-based research and investigation of new agents against cells, against tumor spheres and transplants. Did you give consideration to the inclusion of some kind of research effort in those directions? Or do you really think you can bypass that completely?
No, absolutely no. That's this project is really a nidus for all these things to spin off. So we actually have a joint scientific committee as well that will spin off a large amount of basic science projects. Both at Moffitt, our collaborators, and at Merck, surrounding these samples and the data that's produced. So absolutely, the science is a big part of it.
Right. Yeah. So speaking from the perspective of a clinical investigator, even at a research institution like UCSF, I found that it's actually trying to obtain tumor tissue from patients with metastatic pancreatic cancer has a lot of obstacles, both from logistical and technical standpoints. So just to share with you from a logistical standpoint, getting our IRB to approve protocols where you're just getting a pretreatment biopsy from someone with unresectable disease, where you might interrogate those tumors, but they might not provide direct benefit for the patient. And, God bless our IRB, but they're very obstructionist in terms of thinking that is something that is useful for any given patient there. And then on the second level, as was alluded to before by Dr. Rubin and others, is, even with our best interventional radiologists and pathologists and what looks like a very large liver lesion, you stick a 16-gauge needle in, and oftentimes the yield of tumor tissue you get actually is very scant, not enough RNA to do the kinds of analyses that you want to. And then thirdly, an honest fact is, at least from our experience so far, patients with metastatic pancreas cancer, because of their inanition and everything else, kind of going through a biopsy, the delay of treatments that entails, the turnaround time, et cetera, the truth of the matter is a lot of patients are not consenting to that very important aspect. So I think these are a few of the obstacles in terms of a clinical researcher trying to do translational research. Those are some of the things that we've had to face.
Well, I mean, and I can only echo that. I think you're correct. That's why we have version 8.0 on this protocol. It takes a long time to get the protocol right and to cover all these bases. With regards to pancreas cancer, we've resorted to US FNAs and technology to amplify RNA and DNA. from these small samples. You still have a problem sampling. The needles are bending and they're breaking, and the endoscopist is having a hard time getting samples. So it's not an easy problem to work with pancreas cancer biopsies. Either the primary metastatic liver is a little easier, but
anything from the epidemiological perspective, Meg? You have any comments?
Well, I mean,
could you just hang on for a sec till we get a mic over to you? Thank you.
There were a few. I mean, this is an enormous effort, and I, having worked with a data warehouse and linked databases, I would never underestimate the amount of effort that's gone into build this really ambitious undertaking. I had a couple of questions. One of them was that if we think about some the multitude of disciplines represented in this room, and you know, from a range of institutions that are needed to really make important progress in this disease. I wondered if you could elaborate a little bit about what you were referring to as partners for collaborators. So, for example, if there was a researcher who was not affiliated with one of the institutions that's feeding patients into this resource outside of the state of Florida that wanted to access material, for example, to test a particularly promising agent, or perhaps even just for understanding the tumor biology, do you have in all of these protocols a mechanism by which they could actually apply for access to Moffitt material, or is that material in fact only accessible under certain conditions? So you have to be affiliated with a collaborating institution, or you have to, you know, the PI has to be a Moffitt-based researcher, and so forth.
Well, the short answer to that is it's not a public tumor bank or a public database, but any investigator can come and collaborate with a Moffitt investigator on any project. We certainly collect our own tumors at Moffitt, and part of that gets profiled as part of this project. The rest goes into a Moffitt tumor bank, as we've had for years, and we collaborate with people all over the country sharing samples and so forth. So I think that won't change. Talk to Mace, for example, at Vanderbilt about working with groups that have high volume expertise in a certain discipline like proteomics. They could take advantage of a proteomics resource and embellish, you know, what we have established already and augment it. So it's certainly possible.
Yeah, the second is just a very practical question. So in the situation where you want to get tissues, say in the presence of metastatic disease, where under normal clinical practice you might not get those biopsies, who's paying to get the biopsies on those patients? I mean, you're doing a lot of extra collection that's above and beyond usually what's covered by most conventional insurance.
Yeah, so the way it's designed is that, and many clinical trials are designed this way, but we try to set this up so that when biopsies were done, they were already being done for a diagnostic purpose. So Medicare is paying for the initial diagnostic biopsy in the majority of cases, or private insurance, and then the additional biopsy is basically gratis from the physician doing the biopsy. So we're really not paying anybody extra to do that. It's done at the same time, at the same setting, at the same anesthesia, and at the same CT scan or ultrasound. So.
Okay, so I have one last question because I know that there are others. So given that you had such a wide range of individuals involved in the development of your consenting materials, are those materials available to other institutions? Or are they on the web, or, you know?
Not yet. No, they're not. I haven't thought about that, but we can certainly give some thought to that.
So, Neil Rosen.
Two questions. One is, I'm a little confused about how this works practically in terms of treatment. Pancreas, if you could do the biopsy, but let's just take melanoma, which you can do the biopsy, and even of a central lesion. You get the array in 10 days. What do you treat the patient with?
So that's, you know, that's where the science comes in. That's why you're here. So the idea would be to, if you had, here's an example, if you had, let's say you had a new drug called Herceptin, and you knew that HER2 new was the target and amplified, and we had a database that included HER2 as a measure, you could go find those patients. And as one example, or maybe it was a mutational database and it was c-kit or EGF receptor mutation. In our case right now, it's gene expression profile. So that gets down to, you know, can you, and I was asking Dr. Hunter this last night, can you find a profile, a surrogate of the downstream TK effectors that might be used to match patients. You know, this is where the challenge comes in, is to find the signature in vitro.
Right now, for the most patients, and especially for patients with tumors like pancreas, you're hard-pressed to say what this is going to do for those patients now. The second question is a little more difficult. It's the ethics question. We get a Salk Institute histone deacetylase inhibitor next week that's really great, and you pick out in your profiles 30% of pancreas population that's going to respond real well to an HDAC. Are you going to use Saha, which is made by Merck, or are you going to use the one made by somebody else that looks a lot better for, in your subjective opinion and those of your colleagues? Here's a better drug, better PK, hits the target, hits the HDACs in the pancreas profile better, or are you going to use Saha?
That's actually a very easy question, because the rules of engagement were that we would use the best drug. And so that's right up front, not an issue.
That's in the eye of the beholder. The more obnoxious way I could have asked this is, how much pressure is Merck under to make Rosetta good for something?
I don't know the answer to that, but so far I haven't seen the issues.
So could I ask a sort of general question here in terms of the interaction between the various silos, groups, specialties in here?
Can I just address something here, because it's so important?
Yes, of course you may.
So we tried to get Merck to let us use Saha for pancreatic cancer protocol, had a couple of serious meetings with them, and I don't know if it's just the people that we met with, but actually they refused. They said it has not worked at MD Anderson. It causes too much toxicity and when given with gemcitabine. And even though we explained to them very clearly that our protocol was totally different and would not be associated with toxicity, it was the opposite thing of what you said. So one of the reasons that I felt this is so important is that when we do have agents and targets, and we go to big pharma and we say, look, this is something that's potentially really useful in this deadly disease, they say, no, thank you.
Not always.
Yeah.
No, not always.
That's a different question in that I was going to say something, but Merck should not be under any compulsion to do a trial based on your stuff. That
Correct.
Really is their, you know, it's up to them. I'm more worried about the opposite, of them preventing you from doing. I mean, I think what raises its head is doing Merck-specific drugs, and if you have total freedom.
Well, that's what I said before is we have total freedom to do any trial with any drug company. So we, you know, that was sort of number one, that any pharma, and we work with every pharma company known to mankind. So I don't think that's an issue. Well, not necessarily, no.
Max?
you can certainly talk to me offline about those things.
So just Max, before we go to you, that my question was still there, which was do you feel that there's enough conversation between epidemiologists and scientists? I'm not saying that epidemiologists aren't scientists, but you know what you know. And can we just get you a microphone? Or Gloria, do you want to deal with that one? No, you don't want to touch it.
I've got the same line.
We'll come back next in a second. Thank you.
You know, I thought what your comment about that we've done it for adenomas, for example, is it? I mean, I think that that's critically important if you have the potential to capture premalignant lesions. So is this something that's uniformly part of the protocol? If anybody going in for a colonoscopy at one of the participating hospitals, they're going to become part of this and they're consented because, in fact, cancer might be diagnosed in the course of that colonoscopy, or was that a special protocol?
If you can imagine this, it's a very large project, and so it comes in stages, and so phase one is to try to capture five common diseases, and pancreas is one of them, by the way. So it's one of the key milestone tumor types. But then beyond that, we want to move out into other types, including liquid tumors. And then beyond that, we want to go to premalignant. So we'll do this in phases, but each one's a challenge. So to get polyps from colonoscopy involves a pathologist, and how do you divide the sample, and who gets what, and are they willing to share, and we had to set up tissue escrows along the way, so that the pathology had to be confirmed with a final report before tissue is released for any other project. So steps like that help you get beyond that, but it's still getting polyps and premalignant lesions is tough because the pathologist wants to make the call.
Jordan, since you've got a mic, and then let's get a mic back to Max for the next.
I have a couple points and a question. One point is Murray's point earlier. He and I were just talking. Is something that is a key issue in pancreas cancer, and that's that the pharmaceutical companies like to avoid certain areas where there are excess toxicity. Patients with pancreas cancer tend to be a little bit sicker. So although this specific instance might not have been because of just that, because of other things such as a negative trial already, sometimes they will avoid a disease where they see excess toxicity. I think the classic was, ironically, Vioxx, where they avoided cancer altogether because they were afraid of extra toxicity showing up on their PDR. So that didn't work out well for them. But there are some issues with that. Actually, my real question for you, though, is, so you're going to plan, I mean, you're planning on doing these molecular signatures to choose patients, yet we actually only have a very few, specifically breast cancer, situations where we actually know something about the signature. So let's say you have a new drug, new mechanism of action. How are you going to know that this is the right molecular signature and not miss an entire population that would benefit because you have the wrong molecular signature to start with? I'm a little confused on that.
Yeah, so you have to take that into trial design. And I don't think you can just do a trial off the top and not have a control arm where patients are offered standard of care. So a trial might be, one arm with standard of care and one arm with standard of care plus new drug. And you might, and I think our initial plan is probably to go after responder and non-responder signatures as opposed to specific matches. So you could imagine a trial done with two arms with non-responders to standard therapy being randomized to standard drug or standard drug plus new agent. And that's sort of a trial design that would be, I think, appropriate for this.
Right. It just seems awfully daunting because you also have issues of tumor sampling, some variability, certainly diseases such as pancreas cancer with a high genomic instability. And you have things where, of course, things didn't work out. Jeff was just talking about EGF receptor. And we have all those things where we thought something would predict for effect and it didn't. I love this project. Don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to insult them. I'm just
and don't get me wrong. It is a research project. You know, this is not a. It's a true research project. So there are going to be some dead ends, and there are going to be some challenges that we can't overcome. But if you don't sort of charge out into the unknown, then you won't get anything done. So
let's go to Max. Tim, let's get the microphone up to Thea in the corner for next.
I just wanted to over here. I just wanted to congratulate you on leveraging funding from multiple different sources and getting this off the ground for all of us who've been a large part of tissue bank acquisitions to collect that many samples from that many patients in such a short amount of time is truly awesome. A couple things I wanted to ask you and propose. One would be in your phases of doing this research project, I would think it would be paramount to meet with the large oncology cooperative groups to make sure that they get signatures on patients so that you can begin to, I mean, we've got to be able, your bank has got to be able to talk to the patients that are in those trials based on these signatures. So, you know, there's got to be some standardized way of doing the signatures in these large cooperative group trials. Otherwise, it's going to be very difficult to determine which signature represents a response or not. So I guess my first question would be, you know, are you approaching these large cooperative groups and trying to coordinate that effort? And are there any such groups that are just focused in Florida that you're doing that with?
You know, good questions. No, we haven't yet. I think the cooperative groups actually are going to play a large role. And give you one example in validating some of these signatures, because they do a very good job of collecting large data sets, prospectively well-controlled trials. And you know, the NSABP has hundreds, if not thousands, of patients collected, and most of them are in paraffin. That's a problem, but they do have these samples collected, and they're well annotated. So they're a great resource, I think, for validating some of these signatures before they're actually commercialized and available to the public. It's going to be an important step. And so I think, you know, that's one use. Getting them to move towards frozen tissue on the discovery side is a little harder because there's generally not the resources available at each hospital to pull that off. So I think their role is going to remain in the validation phase of this, of the signatures, as opposed to the discovery. But I'm, you know, open to other ideas.
Two other things. One of them is that there will, if maybe you don't have it with Merck, but there will be significant hurdles to using the signatures to dictate clinical trials. I will tell you right now, because, I mean, a big company in Indiana that makes a very important drug for pancreas cancer, there's a little known fact that there's a gemcitabine receptor and that patients that don't have it on their tumors don't respond. Okay? So the problem with drug companies is that they don't want to limit the number of patients they're giving this drug to, because that goes against one of their principles, trying to stay afloat. You don't have to respond to it, but I'm just saying that.
No, I would like to, because actually I've experienced that a long time ago. We started a trial in colon cancer and went to an unnamed drug company and asked them to sponsor it, and they said no, and then that drug company was bought up by another drug company, and long story short, they ended up funding it anyway, but NIH funded it in the meantime. And so it's important to, I think they're changing, and a lot of these companies are realizing that example you just gave, that same company is going to fund, I think they're going to fund Gerald Bepler to look at his two-gene signature to stratify lung cancer patients. So, you know, the world's changing, and the drug companies that change with it will succeed, and I think that points back to Temple's quote I started at the beginning of this session with, which was the companies better wake up and start trying to identify the biomarkers for their patients and match them to it, because otherwise they're going to end up with these trials with small response rates that won't get approved.
The last thing is I would challenge you to, there was another question in the audience about how you're going to involve the scientists in this. And I think that, you know, the response that you gave was based on the tissues that you have from humans and that sort of thing. But I would challenge you to use the breadth of molecular science in animal models and cell models and use those signatures to see if there's any way that we can translate some of the findings on this side of research to that side. Because that's, you know, I mean, probably 80% of us here are doing basic molecular research in this room. And I think that we do it because we think it might matter to the clinical, you know, clinical importance at some point. So, you know, I don't know too many tissue banks that collect the tumor tissue from animal trials as well as human trials, but, you know, the signatures there might be very important to integrate with this good resource. I think Neil wants to
So, Neil, with a quick follow-up, and then we had, hang on a second, and then we had a, we'll go to Thea after that, and then Daphne was...
Since we're having a bout of industry bashing, which I thoroughly enjoy, I think we should say something else, and just in, if there's a GEMSR receptor, gemcitabine receptor, that the lack of which confers resistance, this is our job. Whether or not it's their job, there's nothing that prevents us from doing that trial and publishing that paper, and then the drug won't be used there anymore. So just remember that we are autonomous free agents here that have an effect as well, and let's not dump everything on them.
I just want to make a comment, Tim, back here, on Jordan's question about how you would use these profiles, especially before you actually have the chemo in hand. And I just came back from a meeting where Dennis Slaman gave this beautiful example about you said non-responders and responders might give you the clue. It's a beautiful story where they give people with breast cancer anthracyclines, very, very little improvement in terms of prognosis. Then what they did is they found out that the anthracyclines were targeting the breast cancers that had increase in topo 2. So now when they went back to the profiles and separated out those, you could see big sky between the two lines. So I think even though the chemical agents aren't there yet, banking these profiles and seeing how they react to at least whatever they're given, it's better than throwing the information away.
Right, and collecting that clinical data longitudinally is the key. Yeah.
Daphne? So I wanted to revisit one of the first issues that Mace brought up, which is, I don't know, you put it probably in a better way, perhaps the false hope that is implicit in some of these large initiatives. And to be more specific, I can certainly see how this approach will stratify between responders and non-responders in a retrospective way. And so I can certainly see how it will become cost-effective because you're not going to actually treat and spend a lot of money treating patients who are going to be non-responders. What I do fail to see is that in parallel, there are going to be so many new things in a pipeline that will offer something different for the non-responders. And this is really what we need to think. If there is not going to be a parallel initiative that will give us many more things to play with as we custom tailor these therapies, then it's back to the issue of genetic consult. You know, what good does it do to a person when you tell them that, you know, they have actually a genetic predisposition, but there is nothing that you can do for them? And so I would just hope, and I don't have the solution for this, but as we think about these large initiatives that cost a lot of money, that we don't end up with this huge amount of data sets that really doesn't help us at all in terms of the people that need it the most. And I didn't necessarily understand when you said, well, there is going to be a scientific component to it. What is it going to be? How does one is going to deal with the non-responders?
Yeah, I think. I look to our trialists, and Mace might want to comment on that, how he would design a trial of responders and non-responders. If he had that information, given that information, what would be your trial design to properly leverage the data set?
It's very tempting to say that based on preclinical data, we have a profile that would predict for response. In fact, if you just think of the sorafenib story, how it was originally developed as a BRAF kinase inhibitor and then found to actually have activity through the VEGF pathway, most likely, and not have activity in the tumor that's most often driven by RAF kinase mutations, namely melanoma, we would have discarded a useful drug. I think in the first step, you have those profiles of responders and non-responders. You have to enroll both to test that hypothesis in patients. You can't just right off the bat exclude a group of patients because bottom line is that our insights might not be complete into the mechanisms of action in people. So once you have that information where you say this does accurately discriminate two groups, then you could use it prospectively. Then I think you have sufficient confidence in that to use it. But the first step, once you get the data, is then to test that and to have people from both sets enrolled.
What are you going to have to offer for the non-responders? This is really, I understand the value of identifying them as a group.
Well, new agents. And there may be some, you know, we'd like to think that all the therapies we bring into patients are rationally designed and the mechanisms are fully understood. They're not. And I think what's going to happen is that we're going to have drugs where the mechanisms may be complex. They may not signal, may not affect one signaling pathway or one element within the cell. And then you have, hopefully, trials in whom individuals with that, you know, non-responder signature can then be enrolled. And then you could get information from the patients who may respond to that and then use it in an iterative fashion going back and forth, trying to refine your understanding about the mechanism of action and the profiles that predict for response. That's one approach.
Yeah. I sort of disagree with both of you because it's my want. But I think, number one, we have an enormous amount of drugs, not few. And number two, more and more, they are not. Many of them are complex because of this rage for promiscuity, but many of them are not complex. They are oligo-targeted or as targeted as possibly can be. And I really think. So I disagree with you about the sorafenib is a sociologic story of a company that had a drug that hit 150 kinases and told everybody else it was one. If you have a targeted drug, you can have something, a word that has gone out of style, hypothesis on who will be sensitive, which you can test in the models we've heard here and see if that's true. I'm looking forward to the day soon when hypothesis-driven gets your grant dinged. But I think we can still have hypotheses. And when you have such a hypothesis, you can do what Genentech did with Herceptin without one array in sight. And that is treat patients with HER2 disease with a HER2 antibody and see if it works. So I am surprised, and maybe I shouldn't be surprised, Tim, because it's really technology that's slightly behind array. I would do something like this based on sequencing, sequencing, and sequencing, which allows you to apply hypotheses to drugs we have that are targeted, of which there are many. So I think actually the problem is actually the opposite of what Daphne said. We're going to have dozens of drugs for dozens of targets with no profiles in humans that suggest sensitivity or resistance. And the key is going to be to have a hypothesis on in which patient population they will work. On the other hand, Mace, I wouldn't be totally disagreeing with you. If it doesn't work, if a BRAF drug doesn't work in melanoma, it doesn't mean there's not a disease somewhere else that we haven't thought of yet where it will. So I wouldn't confine it to that afterwards. But you have to figure out, based on hypothesis, what your best shot is.
So on that note, I mean, could we sort of table this, take a 15-minute break? There's obviously some questions here that you'll need to address in groups a little later on. But I think at this point, if we take a 15-minute break and come back for the Ralph Rubin session at 2:45, that'd be great.